Welcome back to Catholic Answers Live Open Forum. I'm Cy Kellett, your host. Jimmy Akin is our guest. And if there's a theme for the last hour, it was how uncool I am. It just kept coming up over and over again.
No.
I didn't even know Facebook was over.
It's not over. It's just young people don't use it the way they did.
Yeah, yeah. What are they doing? Instagram?
Or other various apps.
Yeah, Twitter maybe.
No, that's kind of skews older too.
Old people. TikTok, you're saying?
TikTok maybe.
Okay. I guess the theme of this hour is going to be the same as last hour, because now I got to go look up what TikTok is. Thanks, Nick. I'm going to the phones. That's it. I've had enough of this. I'm going to the phones.
Jimmy Akin. Wow. That Alexander Graham Bell old school technology. How about that?
I know who Alexander Graham Bell is. Some of these young TikTokers might not even know. I really like Alexander Graham Bell. You know, he's trying to help deaf people. Mm-hmm. That was his motivation. Did you know that?
I did not.
He thought that he could develop a technology that could make it loud for mm-hmm. deaf people.
And who was the first phone call placed to?
Watson.
Watson, that's right.
Okay. Oh.
His assistant, yeah.
My dear Watson or something.
He got startled and said, Watson, I need you.
That's funny. And that was a long time ago, the mm-hmm. invention of the telephone.
Yeah, it was over 100 years.
That wasn't even the last century. That was century before the last century.
Correct, yeah. So sure, you read the Sherlock Holmes stories, and he's using a telephone and stuff.
Really?
Mm-hmm.
I often run into that when I read Mark Twain sometimes when he talks. There's one wonderful Mark Twain essay about getting an electric...
A typewriter? Not typewriter. That's a different story.
Yeah, no. He gets some kind of electric alarm in his house in Connecticut,
okay.
and he writes about that. And I'm thinking, you think of Mark Twain as so long ago,
mm-hmm.
but
he also got a. He did, this is a true story. He also got a typewriter at one point, and he sold it because he didn't like using it.
Oh yeah.
And then he sold it. Ended up buying another one. And the manufacturer wanted him to give them an endorsement so that they could sell, use that to sell more typewriters. Hey, the most popular author in America uses one of our typewriters. And he wrote them a letter back saying he didn't want anybody to even know that he had one of these cantankerous little jokers that he found so frustrating. And so they printed his letter of refusing to endorse it.
Oh, that's good. Well,
used it as an endorsement anyway.
Yeah, yeah. That's the typewriter. Let me tell you my personal typewriter story, mm-hmm. if I may. One time with my kids, we're camping on the beach and we're eating corn on the cob,
mm-hmm.
and I started doing the typewriter thing with the corn on the cob.
Oh yeah. And they didn't know what the ding was.
They were like, "What are you doing?" And I said, "I'm being a typewriter." Mm-hmm. And I thought that would explain it. And they said, all three of them. What is a typewriter? They had never even seen one.
You know what? You're in my generation. A typewriter was a machine, right?
Oh yeah, right.
Not originally.
Oh,
originally the typewriter was the writer who typed. If you could use a typewriter, you were a typewriter.
If you can write type, you're a typewriter.
Yeah, and same thing is true of the word computer. Originally. Back in World War II, when they had the Manhattan Project out in New Mexico, they were building the atomic bomb. So you had all these scientists who were working on the equations and stuff. But then you had their wives who were bored out of their minds in this army desert.
Really, in Alamogordo, New Mexico.
Yeah, exactly. And they were desperate for something to do. And so they said, the electronic computer hasn't really been invented yet. We need a lot of calculations done.
So these women were out there calculating.
It was an example of what's called Monte Carlo science, which is kind of a fun thing in and of itself. But they needed all this number crunching done, and so the wives were so bored. It's like, let's do the number crunching, even though they didn't know what the numbers were for. And since they were doing all this computing, they became the computers.
Oh, they were just called the computers.
Yeah, and then eventually that also got transferred to a machine that did the same thing.
Isn't that funny? And now people want to marry their computers, but that's
So now we have typists and typewriters, and we have computer operators and computers.
Yeah. Oh, right, right. And if you don't know what a typewriter is, because you're young, like our last caller, Grace, just look it up on the internet. I'm sure there's a video of it.
It's an early dedicated word processing machine that's
non-digital. It's a word processing machine.
Usually.
Nathan in New Hampshire, you are next. Nathan's listening on the Catholic Answers Live app. Thank you, Nathan. Nathan, your question for Jimmy.
I just want to say, first of all, you guys are invaluable. I almost listen to you all day. I'm on the road a lot. I just started coming back to church about 2 years ago. I was baptized Catholic, confirmed Catholic.
But praise God for that, Nathan.
For the most part of my adult life, God was not part of my life, but it is now. It's a great journey, and I'm learning. I recently got engaged to a girl. She's a better Christian than I am. She's not Catholic. She's going through RCIA. And I think, like any Protestant, she has her skepticisms and she's got her questions. The biggest question that I have, and I had a really hard time explaining to her, is I obviously advocate that the Catholic Church is the one true church started by Jesus Christ. Mm-hmm. Her opinion is that Christianity in general is, quote unquote, the church that Jesus started. And she has a hard time thinking that, you know, one particular sect of Christianity, mainly Catholicism, is, you know, the right way. Mm-hmm. I guess I'm having a hard time explaining that, you know, to me, the Catholic Church, like, we're it. Like, you know, all these other denominations started with a man and a date. We started with Jesus. But she's like, Christianity is the church. So how do I explain it to her better that I guess,
okay.
I don't want to...
So this is a common idea. I had to work through this when I was becoming Catholic as well. There is a common idea in Protestant circles that all Christians together make up Jesus's church, at least all true believers, everyone who's authentically a Christian, whether or not they say they're a Christian. There's some group of Christians that are authentically and they're true believers, and that's the church. And this is sometimes referred to as an invisible church because it's not like there's a visible institution that all these different Christians belong to. They go to different churches. They go to different visible institutions, but they're scattered throughout these different institutions invisibly united to each other. And so this is the invisible church theory, it's sometimes called. The question is whether that corresponds to the way that Jesus uses the term church when he talks about it, and also whether it corresponds to the way others New Testament authors use the term. But in particular, when you look at the way Jesus uses the term, if you really think about it, it's clear that he's not talking about an invisible institution. Because if the church were just the spiritual union of all believers, well, then that invisible church would not have leaders, you know, who are capable of making laws for that church, and they wouldn't be capable of including or excluding people from that spiritual union. Because whether you have spiritual union with God is between you and God. You couldn't excommunicate somebody from an invisible church. And there would be no hierarchy in such a church because, by definition, it's invisible. It's not a structured, visible institution that has leaders and followers. So if you look at the way Jesus uses the concept of church, he does it in particular in two places in the Gospel of Matthew, most notably in Matthew 16, although he also talks about it in Matthew 18. Well, let's look at Matthew 18 first because it's the briefer of the two instances. There, Jesus says, if your brother sins against you, talk to him privately. If you can't get satisfaction, bring along someone else who can witness to the situation. And if he doesn't listen to that person, take it to the church. And if he won't listen even to the church, treat him like a Gentile or a tax collector, meaning someone who's not a member. So treat him like he's not a member of the church anymore. He's been excommunicated. So right there, we have Jesus. Now, there's no way to approach an invisible union of people.
It's pretty old.
Yeah.
Or if you did, you wouldn't know when you were
getting
close.
You wouldn't know, are you? Yeah. And there's also no way to exclude someone from an invisible union of people. And so this very clearly presupposes the church as a visible institution that can excommunicate people. So right there, you have a couple of both on the take it to the church part and the treat him like an outsider part. You have a clear understanding on Jesus's behalf of the church as a visible institution. So then we go and look at the slightly more expansive passage, which is Matthew 16. In Matthew 16, Jesus says, "You are Peter, and on this rock I will build my church, and the gates of hell will not prevail against it." He goes on to say, "Whatever you bind in, I will give you the keys to the kingdom of heaven, and whatever you bind on earth will be bound in heaven. Whatever you loose on earth will be loosed in heaven." Well, we today aren't that familiar with this binding and loosing concept. We don't use that today in contemporary English, but it was actually well understood in first century Judaism. In fact, we have the Jewish historian Josephus, who was born like AD 37, just 4 years after the crucifixion. He talks about it, and he talks about, and he knows exactly what it means. It refers to, among other things, the ability to establish and abolish rules of conduct or laws for the community. It's a legislative power. And he talks about that in terms of the Pharisees at one time having had this. He mentions that during the reign of the Jewish queen Alexandra, she really liked the Pharisees. She was a big supporter of the Pharisees. And so they could use that influence with her to make policy for the kingdom. And so he says the Pharisees during Queen Alexandra's reign had the power of binding and loosing, so they could effectively make rules or laws for the community. Well, Jesus invested that in his church. But if it's an invisible union of believers, who has the lawmaking authority? Where's the mechanism by which you can establish or abolish the rule? It doesn't make any sense. I mean, you have to know who has a vote. You have to be able to count the votes. You have to be able to know exactly who has this authority. And in an invisible union, there's no way to do all that. So Jesus is making it clear that his church is to have leaders. He also, by the way, in Matthew 18, shares this binding and loosing power with others besides just Peter. That rulemaking authority, that legislative authority, is something that can be exercised only in a visible church. You have to know who the leaders are, who the lawmakers are, who the law is binding on. And then also we have this thing about it, the church being built on Peter. You know, read in context, and, you know, there are some questions that people will have about, is Peter really the rock? The answer is yes. And I won't go into the full details of why at the moment, but Jesus is appointing Peter to be the leader of the church, particularly after he ascends back to heaven. And there's more to say about all this, but I know we need to take a break. So what I'll do is just recommend a paper that I wrote. It's on my personal website, jimmyakin.com. It's called "Why Be Catholic? An Exercise for Evangelicals." And it's a speech I gave at an evangelical seminary where I went through these arguments about how if we look at Jesus's own conception of what his church would be, it points not to the invisible union of all believers, but specifically to a visible institutional church with leaders and followers and rules and excommunications and being built on Peter in a special way.
That's so, at jimmyakin.com?
Right. And just Google Jimmy Akin, "Why Be Catholic? An Exercise for Evangelicals."
Thanks, Nathan. Got to take a break. Right back with more Open Forum with Jimmy Akin right after this.
A while back, I had a nice little chat with some Jehovah Witness ladies, and they tried to justify their claim to be Christian by saying the early Christians didn't believe Jesus was God. Is this true? Well, of course not. Let me share a few examples. Take John 1:1, where John describes Jesus as the Word and writes the Word was God. Now, in order to get around this, the JWs translate the phrase as the Word was a God. But this is based on a misunderstanding of Greek grammar. Consider also Colossians 2:9, where St. Paul writes, "For in him, that is Jesus, the whole fullness of deity dwells bodily." In 1 Corinthians 8:6, Paul describes Jesus as the one through whom we exist. Isn't God the one ultimately responsible for the existence of things? So, contrary to what the JWs think, to be Christian, you must believe Jesus is God. I'm Carlo Broussard with A Ready Reason for Catholic Answers, Catholic.com.
The leading Catholic voices are on EWTN Radio.
I want to talk to you about the importance of bringing the news to you every day. And we do that two ways on Catholic Connection. Firstly, we give you a newscast that I write and give to you to keep you up to date on what's happening in the world in the church. And then we also do interviews daily to help you understand everything from a truly Catholic perspective.
Catholic Connection with Teresa Tomeo, tomorrow morning, 9 Eastern, on EWTN Radio.
Welcome back. Open Forum. Jimmy Akin, our guest, and tons of folks on the line, so I'm going to just keep going. Dan in Allen Park, Michigan, listening on Ave Maria Radio. Dan, thank you for your call. Your question for Jimmy.
Oh, thank you. Thank you for taking my call. Hi, Jimmy. How are you?
Doing okay.
My question is, what is the Catholic Church's belief when a human being passes away or dies? Is that person automatically judged at that point in time? And I'm also wondering, you know, after the second coming of Christ, is the body and soul united back together again? I could just get your thoughts on that. I'd appreciate it.
Okay, so the church understands that, yes, when a person dies, they are judged. The exact chronology of that is not determined. I mean, it could be the instant you die, you were in Christ's presence being judged. On the other hand, in the parable of Lazarus and the rich man, which is a parable, but, you know, Jesus's parables tend to be informed by things in the real world, you know, like, so when he says there was a king or there was a father who had two sons, or, well, okay, there are fathers that have sons and there are kings and things like that. So Jesus does tend to form his parables based in one degree or another on real things. Well, in Lazarus and the rich man, when Lazarus dies, he's carried off to the bosom of Abraham by angels. And that suggests a journey of some type that is mediated by angels. So the angels are helping bring him to this place of rest and comfort. And so it's possible that we're in Jesus's presence the instant we die, or it's possible that there is some kind of interlude that happens before we're in Jesus's presence. And some people have even speculated that that may be part of what's happening with the near-death experiences that people have, where they report encountering a being of light that some people interpret as an angel,
mm-hmm.
and they're taken through a tunnel, and they see this light, and then they end up in this beautiful place, or not. And
that's the part. I don't like those so much.
Yeah. And so it's, you know, we don't know the specific chronology of it, but either at or shortly after death, yeah, we receive what's called the individual judgment, which occurs to us spiritually. Our spirits are affected by this, but because our bodies are no longer with us, we're not affected bodily by what this particular judgment. Then at the end of time, the end of history, I should say, there is the general judgment where we are reunited with our bodies and we're judged again. This is different than the particular judgment, number one, in that it's public rather than private. Because someone, you know, my wife dies, I don't see her particular judgment. That's private. You know, yeah. I have no access to that.
I bet you come up, though.
At the general judgment though, Jesus says, whatever we've said in private will be shouted from the housetop. So it's a public judgment. So God's justice and mercy are vindicated before everybody. Also at that point, we have our body back. So not only are we glorified or not in spirit, we're now glorified or not in body as well. So that's why there is this separate judgment at the end of history. In terms of when exactly we get our bodies back in relation to the second coming, this is something that I think also there is a little bit of room for debate about, you know, does Jesus come back first and then the dead rise, or exactly how that works. That seems to be what is indicated, because when, and in 1 Thessalonians 4, Paul is talking about, and in the also elsewhere in the Thessalonian epistles, he talks about the second coming and how when Jesus returns, the dead will rise first, and then all of us will be caught up to be with Jesus. So even though you could debate about exactly the timing of some of this, at the second coming, we will get our bodies back, and then we will have the general judgment.
Thank you, Dan, for that question. 888-318-7884, our number here. It is open forum, and someone has a puppy in the studio. How am I supposed to do the show now with a King Charles Spaniel puppy in here? All right, I'm going to try to soldier on. John,
they're so cute.
I know. John in Portland, Oregon, listening on Modern Day Radio. You are up next. John, your question for Jimmy Akin. No? Did I click the wrong button? I've been doing that lately. I don't know. All week I've been clicking the wrong button, but I think I went to the right one. John, are you there? All right. I'm going to have to go to Chad in Kentucky, listening on Facebook Live, but I'm going to come back to you, John. If you wake up in a minute and hear this, I'm going to come back to you. So Chad in Kentucky, your question for Jimmy.
Hey, are you there?
There we go. Hi, Chad.
Hey, I got you guys now. Good job. My question is going to be about contraceptives.
Okay.
My wife and I, I'm a fresh convert to the Catholic faith. Mm-hmm. My wife and I were Baptist when we were married.
Mm-hmm.
We have three kids. We're 1 4 weeks old.
Oh, congratulations.
The other day. Yeah, thanks. I can barely hear you guys.
Okay. We can hear you fine, though, so go ahead with your question.
Okay. So she used to take the injection that lasts for 3 years to mm-hmm. not get pregnant when we were Baptist, because at that time, we didn't have a problem with that as Baptist. Mm-hmm. But now that I'm a Catholic, I agree with 100% the Catholic teaching on contraceptives.
Mm-hmm.
She is not Catholic.
Mm-hmm.
She still wants to get it. So my question is, where does that leave me? Do I withhold intimacy from her? What do I do with that?
Okay. This is something that the church has looked at, and there's actually a document which I'll mention to you. The title of the document is the Vademecum for Confessors. Vademecum is a Latin word. It literally means in Latin, go with me. It's like a little handbook that you take with you.
Mm-hmm.
So it's called the Vademecum, Vademecum. I'll spell that once more, and you can always check the spelling on the podcast, but Vademecum, the Vademecum for Confessors. And what this is a little handbook for confessors who have penitents come to them in confession and have questions of this nature. And one of the questions it deals with is, what if you have a spouse who insists on using contraception? How do you deal with that? Well, it says that you can continue to be physically intimate, provided certain conditions are met. One of them is you need to be honest with the spouse that, you know, you're not in favor of contraception. You also, when it's opportune, and that's not every single time, obviously, but when it's opportune, you need to raise that subject for discussion when you think your spouse might be open to reconsidering it. But that's a judgment call. I mean, they may just never be open to reconsidering it. But if you sense the opportunity, well, then you want to do your best to take advantage of that. And also you yourself must not be doing anything wrong. So you can't use the contraception, but your spouse, if the spouse insists on using it, then that doesn't prevent you from being able to be intimate. There are some other qualifiers that one would want to make, but that's the basic answer. And if you need a more detailed answer, particularly depending on the method that your wife is using, I would say contact the National Catholic Bioethics Center. They are an organization of biomedical experts, and you know, who specialize in ethics. They're very orthodox. They're very faithful to church teaching. And their website is ncbcenter.org. ncbforcatholic.org. That's NCB for National Catholic Bioethics Center.org. And they can, you just go to their website, contact them, ask for a consultation, and they'll help you out.
Thank you very much, Chad. I'm going to try to go back to John in Portland. We'll see if he's there. John, do we have you with us?
Yeah, can you hear me now?
We can, yes, John. Go ahead with your question for Jimmy.
Good. So I started reading the Bible for the first time, and I'm making my way through the Gospels.
Uh-huh.
And something that I've noticed is that Luke is the only one that recounts the repentance of the criminal on the cross next to Jesus during the crucifixion.
Yep.
And something else that I've learned this week is that the Bible, you know, one of our Catholic teachings is that it doesn't contradict itself. Mm-hmm. But when I go back and I read Mark and Matthew, both Mark and Matthew recount the criminals ridiculing Jesus until he died. So how do I deal with this apparent contradiction, and what does it mean? How should I be looking at this?
John, thank you. You could probably hear the music. We have to wait about a minute or so, and we'll get Jimmy's answer to that about how do we deal with apparent contradictions among the four Gospels. We'll get to that and many more questions right after this on Catholic Answers Live.
You're listening to Catholic Answers Live.
Tim Staples, Trent Horn, Cy Kellett, Chris Check, Carlo Broussard. Our on-fire lineup of speakers will inform and inspire your audience to grow in their Catholic faith. For more information on booking a Catholic Answers speaker for your event, visit CatholicAnswersSpeakers.com today.
Have you subscribed to the Catholic Answers Radio Club newsletter? This is Catholic Answers Live host Cy Kellett, and I want to tell you about our new weekly newsletter full of behind-the-scenes information and facts you need to know about the show. It's easy to sign up. Just visit CatholicAnswersLive.com and look for the newsletter sign-up box on the front of the page. It's a great way to keep up to date with what's happening with the show and see what's coming in the days ahead, delivered weekly into your inbox. Sign up today for the Catholic Answers Radio Club newsletter and see what you've been missing. Go to CatholicAnswersLive.com.
Many Catholics ignore the Bible. They say they have the Church instead. But we should embrace sacred Scripture, not just as the revealed Word of God, but as a Catholic work, intimately connected with the Church from the earliest centuries. In The Bible is a Catholic Book, apologist Jimmy Akin shows how the Bible cannot exist apart from the Church, in its origins, in the truths it contains, in its careful preservation over the centuries. Scripture is inseparable from the Catholic faith. This is fitting, since both come from God for our salvation. If you're a Catholic who sometimes gets intimidated by the Bible is a Catholic Book will help you better understand and take pride in this gift that God gave the world through the Church. After all, Catholics are the original Bible Christians. Order your copy of The Bible is a Catholic Book today by calling 1-844-239-4952, visiting shop.catholic.com, or asking for it at a good Catholic bookstore near you.
Dr. David Anders here. Where is purgatory in the Bible? Why confess my sins to a priest?
Find out more tomorrow at 2 p.m. Eastern on Call to Communion.
Now, back to Catholic Answers Live.
Welcome back to Catholic Answers Live. When we went to the break, John in Portland, Oregon, listening on Modern Day Radio, was asking Jimmy Akin, our guest, about how to deal with what appeared to be contradictions among the Gospels. He mentioned particularly, I think, Mark and Matthew.
So the and how they relate to Luke with regard to the thieves that Jesus was crucified between. So one of the things that, and I talk about this in The Bible is a Catholic Book, one of the things that modern people frequently aren't aware of is just how fantastically expensive books were in the ancient world, because they had to be hand copied. So you had to pay someone to copy every letter of every word of the entire book by hand. That's how scribes made their living. Also, you couldn't just go down to Office Depot and get a package of 500 sheets of paper. Every piece of papyrus had to be handmade by cutting up, first growing, then cutting up and stitching together this reed from Egypt. Or if you were writing on parchment, which is made from animal skins, you had to grow the animal, then slaughter it, take its skin, scrape it off, stretch it out, dry it, tan it, bleach it, get rid of the hairs, cut it into shape, and stuff like that. So the writing materials...
That got a little gross for a minute there.
Oh, what? You didn't grow up on a farm, city boy?
Just for a second. I prefer the Office Depot. Thank you very much. Okay.
In any event, because of all this was very labor intensive, books were really, really, really expensive. And so a single copy of the Gospel of Matthew, as short as it is, by modern standards, would have cost more than $2,000. Or the equivalent of more than $2,000 in the ancient world. And so most people simply could not afford books. And those who could wanted them to be short because you don't want to waste any words when you're paying $2,000 for something as short as Matthew. And so that means that the evangelists had to keep their works short, and that means they couldn't write down everything they knew about Jesus. In fact, John even comments on that. If you look in John chapter 21, at the very end of his gospel, he says that Jesus did a lot of other things that aren't even mentioned in this book, and Jesus did so many things that, he says hyperbolically, I don't even think the world would hold all the books that would need to be written. Now, that's hyperbole, but what he means is there's way more that I know about Jesus than I could put down here for you. And that was true of the other evangelists as well. So they had to make choices. What were they going to record and what were they not going to record in their book? Because they needed to keep it short enough to fit on a single scroll. That's why the Gospels are more or less all about the same length. They were designed to fit on a single scroll, each one of them. So Matthew and Mark chose to emphasize certain things to communicate to their audiences. Luke chose to emphasize other things for his audience. In the case of Matthew and Mark, they wanted to show their audiences just how rejected and despised Jesus was by other people. And so they record how the guards mocked him, how the priests mocked him, how the passersby mocked him, and then also how the thieves mocked him. But as Jesus conducted himself on the cross, some people started changing their minds. You see this, for example, in Mark's gospel, where after the example Jesus has set on the cross, when Jesus dies, the Roman centurion there, the guy who's in charge of all the soldiers, says, surely this man was the Son of God.
Mm-hmm.
So he came around. And Mark wants to show how even the centurion came around. Well, Luke wants to knows this tradition also about the good thief. He knows that there's this tradition that the thieves mocked him, and he has the bad thief mocking him. But he also knows that the good thief came around. He just doesn't. He talks about how Jesus assured the good thief that he would be with him in paradise, but that doesn't mean that I guess what I'm saying is he just chooses not to complicate the story for his readers by mentioning, oh yeah, the good thief also mocked him initially, but then came around like the centurion did. At least that's one option for how you could understand this, that Luke is simply mentioning this additional detail, even though that the good thief later spoke favorably of Jesus, even though he'd initially spoken hostily towards Jesus. And he just mentions the latter fact because he doesn't want to confuse the reader or lengthen his gospel with a lengthier explanation of how the good thief came around. On the other hand, there's another possibility. You know how, Cy, let's say someone comes up to you and, you know, expresses an opinion.
Okay.
Like, they like chocolate ice cream.
Okay.
Okay. Well, you might say, a single person came up to me and said that they like chocolate ice cream. Or you might say, some people like chocolate ice cream.
Yeah.
And you might say some people like chocolate ice cream, even though only one person came up to you and said that.
Yeah, right.
That's a so you're referring to a class of people and you use the plural, even though it's really just one person came and expressed that opinion.
Right.
And that same dynamic could be what's going on in Matthew and Mark. Matthew and Mark know that somebody among the thieves dissed Jesus on the cross, mocked Jesus on the cross. So they just say, so the priests mocked him. Well, not all of the priests. You know, some of the priests were good guys. The passersby mocked him. Well, it doesn't mean all of the passersby mocked him. The disciples were there.
Right.
His mom was there. They were bystanders. They didn't mock him, but some of them did. So he speaks of them as a group. And some in the group of the people he was crucified with also mocked him. And so they just say, oh, and the thieves mocked him. But that doesn't mean every single person in that class mocked him. And Luke brings out the fact that that one of them definitely did not, or at least by the end, did not mock him. And it may have been the case that he never did mock him. And so when Matthew and Mark say the thieves did mock him, they're speaking of them as a class without implying that every single member of that class did so, the same way they speak of these other groups as a class without implying every single member did so. So both of these are possibilities. In terms of how to reconcile these different passages. And that expresses the same basic strategy you want to look at whenever you're looking at a seeming difference between the Gospels. A difference does not mean a contradiction. And just because it records one thing in one place and another thing in another place doesn't mean there aren't ways of fitting those things together. I would suggest my book, A Daily Defense, where I have a discussion of a number of different ways of harmonizing, that's what this is called, harmonizing, different details that are found in different parts of Scripture. So you may want to check that out.
Thank you. 888-318-7884, the number. It is open forum. Let's go to Mike in Florida, listening on Sirius XM satellite radio. That's EWTN channel 130. Mike, your question for Jimmy.
Hey, guys. Good evening. Hi. Jimmy, good book. The Bible's Catholic book. Just read it. One day. I got a two-part question for you, man.
Okay.
I am Catholic, but I'm struggling with something. How can we say that Muslims worship the same God when the Quran clearly says that Allah has no son, has begotten no son?
Mm-hmm.
And then in John chapter 8, Jesus goes as far as calling the Jews their father is the devil because they do not believe that he's come from God.
Well, he doesn't.
I'm struggling with.
Yeah, Jesus doesn't say their father is the devil because they don't believe that he's come from God. I think the causal arrow goes the other way, because they have committed themselves to purposes other than God's. So he can metaphorically speak of the devil as their father, since the devil opposes God's work, because clearly the devil is not their biological father. This is a metaphor. For that reason, they have closed their eyes to the fact that that he has come from God. But setting that aside, well, okay, so Muslim people don't believe that Jesus is the Son of God, and they're wrong. But that doesn't mean that when they talk to the creator of the universe who appeared to Abraham, God doesn't know that they're not talking to him. God doesn't know that they're talking to him. I may believe, so Si, you have a son, right?
Yes.
What's the name of your son?
Graham.
Graham. Okay. So, I might think, you have no son,
mm-hmm.
you know, I might not know that, but if I talk to you under the mistaken belief that you have no son, does that mean I'm not really talking to you?
No, it does not. It's still me.
Yeah, exactly. And in the same way, Jewish people who weren't Christians and who aren't Christians genuinely believed in God, genuinely worshiped God, even though they didn't think God had a son. Jesus says, you believe in God, believe also in me. So he acknowledges they believe in God. He's urging them to go further and acknowledge him as the Son of God. But they already believed in God, even though they didn't think God had a son. And the same thing is true of Muslims. If they are addressing their prayers to the creator of the universe, the creator of the universe knows they're talking to him. If they're addressing their prayers to the God of Abraham who appeared to Abraham, the God who appeared to Abraham knows they're talking to him. So you can have mistaken ideas about somebody and still talk to that person. In fact, I would say probably most of us have mistaken ideas about almost everybody we talk to. You know, people are not always what we think they are. There's always some little difference, hopefully not too big of a one. But all of us have misimpressions of other people, and it doesn't stop us from talking to them.
Mike, got to leave it there. Got to take a break. Hey, even though Lent has begun, we still have the 20 Answers Challenge Pack available to you. All 38 books in the 20 Answers series are 60% off when you buy the group at shop.catholic.com.
Dude, I thought you said you don't do math.
What did I do?
Well, you got like 38 books in a 20 Answers series at 60% off.
I'm just reading numbers. Not actually doing math. See, they wrote it all down for me. and you can get free shipping anywhere in the continental United States. And the primary reason for that is we really want to make the people in Alaska and Hawaii mad. Just go to shop.catholic.com.
Dude, that is not the reason. That is totally not the reason. Well, no, the reason
it's probably super expensive to mail them.
Exactly,
to Alaska.
The economics are different. But if we could, we absolutely would.
We would?
Yeah.
All right.
We would make it available to everybody in the world if we could at that price.
Even the people in Australia?
Yeah.
All right. We are nice. I didn't realize how nice we are.
Yeah. It's that whole, you know, Jesus wants us to be nice thing.
Oh, yeah. Go to shop.catholic.com and get your 60% off. And if you live in the 48 contiguous, you can also get free shipping right now at shop.catholic.com.
We'll be right back with more Catholic Answers Live.
You've heard that St. Paul Street Evangelization supports hundreds of teams of evangelists sharing the good news. But did you know that some of these teams are public prayer stations? Set up a sign on the sidewalk and offer prayer and encouragement to those you encounter. Everyone needs prayer. Try this new method of witnessing to Jesus. Contact St. Paul Street Evangelization to get started at streetevangelization.com. That's streetevangelization.com.
He is only one of four popes honored as the great.
Matthew Bunsen and the Doctors of the Church.
St. Leo I was pope at a time when Roman civilization was being overrun by barbarian armies. He stood as a light in the darkness and even saved the city of Rome from destruction by Attila and the Huns. Leo died in 461.
For more about the Doctors of the Church, visit doctorsofthechurch.com.
Catholic Answers Live, open forum. Jimmy Akin, our guest. Let me just take a minute to, if you're in anywhere near Dublin, Ohio, I have the great honor and privilege of speaking after the Masses on Saturday and Sunday this weekend at St. Mary's in Dublin, Ohio. And I would love to say hello to you there. Come by and say hello if it's within a reasonable distance.
Will you also be speaking in Dublin, Ireland?
No, but wouldn't that be awesome?
Mm-hmm.
Not in the same weekend. That would be a lot of work. That
would be a big plane trip in there.
Dublin is the fastest growing city in the world.
Is it?
Yeah, it's Dublin every year.
Thank you.
Okay.
I did it.
And I was just about to treat that as serious and challenge it on numerical grounds.
I feel so good about myself. Didn't I got one past Jimmy Akin.
Then you yank the rug out and, you're just making a corny joke. Okay.
Emma in Idaho.
What about Triplin, Ohio?
That would be even faster growing.
Yeah.
Yes.
Logarithmic Ohio.
I don't know what logarithmic means, but it's still funny because there's no place called logarithmic.
Logarithmic is even faster than exponential.
Oh, all right. But I have been to Exponential, Ohio. It's a lovely spot.
Mm-hmm.
But this week we'll be in Dublin, Ohio, starting Saturday after the Saturday evening mass. Emma in Idaho, listening on the EWTN app. You are next. Your question, please, for Jimmy Akin.
Hi.
Hi, Emma.
So I'm pestering you again about Mary. Okay.
And I'm reading Why We Are Catholic.
Mm-hmm.
But I was listening, when I listened to Trent Horn, and, you know, he used to be on Bible Answer Man, and why he became Catholic is he started studying the church fathers. And I'm wondering if you can tell me, like, should I go to Wikipedia, or what did they say about Mary?
Okay. Well, so if you're wanting to determine, you know, what various church fathers said about Mary, I would say the most expeditious way to find that out is probably not Wikipedia. I don't even know if Wikipedia has a page on the church fathers and Mary. And if they did, it's likely to not address some of the interests that you would have. I would suggest going to Catholic.com. Because at Catholic.com, for many years, I wrote a column called The Fathers Know Best, which was a series of excerpts from the church fathers placed under the topic that you're interested in. And then within that topic, there'd be a little introduction, but then I'd present relevant quotations from the church fathers in chronological order so you could see how the ideas they were expressing, how the language they used developed over the course of time. And there are a number of different Fathers Know Best things that I wrote showing different aspects of what they said about Mary. So, you know, talking about, for example, her perpetual virginity, the various graces that God gave her. Can she and the saints, you know, respond to our prayers, things like that. And so I would go to Catholic.com and type in Mary Fathers, and several things should come up that will have quotations from the church fathers on the subject.
So I go to Catholic.com and then I go to Fathers Know Best?
There's a search feature. So I would go to Catholic.com and then I would use the search box and I would type in Mary and Fathers.
And if you go there while we're doing this program, you'll also see Jimmy and I streaming live because they've got a new feature there where the show streams live when you go to the webpage Catholic. It's pretty cool,
isn't it? Super streamy.
Super streamy. I don't like to complain, Nick, but I just realized it's the last segment and I never heard any.
Ooh.
You know what I'm going to say, right? It's Thursday. Jimmy's here. All of the criteria have been met. And yet we never heard the groovy music. You know what? Lent.
Hey,
maybe it's Lent.
I'm going to be back on Tuesday. We could hear the groovy music then.
I will gladly pay you Tuesday for groovy music today. No, that's not.
No, it's the other way around.
Yeah. I'll gladly pay you today for groovy music. It's okay, Nick. Yeah, it feels very penitential. No, I won't be wimpy about that. It feels very penitential that you didn't play the groovy music today. Let's see who's up next. Another Emma. A second Emma. Two Emmas in a row. Emma in Portland, Oregon, listening on Modern Day Radio. You are up next. Emma, your question for Jimmy.
Hi,
Emma.
My question is, why are there rare cases when a married Protestant minister converts and is able to become a priest, but a Catholic man once married cannot become a priest?
Okay. So there are a couple things to say there. The first one is the basic reason why the church determined that in the Latin Rite it would make exceptions on occasion for Protestant ministers who are becoming Catholic is to facilitate their reconciliation with the church because they're trained to be ministers. You know, they weren't trained to be architects or doctors or something. And it would be very difficult for them to, you know, convert and have to abandon the line of work they know, which is being a minister, for a completely different career that they're not trained for. And, I mean, maybe they would need to do that for a few years while they got ready for ordination, but it would be much harder for them on a practical level to say, I'm going to become a Catholic and I'm just going to walk away from what I'm trained to do and learn how to do something completely different and rebuild my family level income in a completely different field. So the church wanted to make it easier for them to be reconciled with the church, and that's why they did that. The second thing they need to be said is married Catholic men can be ordained to the priesthood, not typically in the Latin Rite, though, but they can in other rites. There are more than 20 Catholic churches that are in communion with each other. And in many of them, in the Eastern Catholic churches, married men can be ordained to the priesthood. So even if you're a Latin Rite man, you could always be married and then you join an Eastern Catholic church and you get ordained in the Eastern Catholic church if that's what your calling is. So it's possible, but it's not the norm in the Latin Rite.
All right. I guess we'll leave it there. I thought we were going to go back to Emma, but we won't. 888-318-7884, the number. Jimmy, our guest, and Renee is next. Renee is listening from New Jersey on 88.9 FM. Renee, your question for Jimmy.
Hi. So I had a question having to do with like the problem of suffering and evil. Mm-hmm. You know, God doesn't really need us, and I can accept that, like, with free will, it's going to mean that there is sin and pain and suffering. Mm-hmm. I just don't understand why, in the first place, God would have created if he didn't really need us.
Okay. Because he wanted to, because he chose to. It's true, he doesn't need us. There is nothing in him that compelled him to create, but he also wasn't deterred from creating by the fact that there would be evil and suffering in the world, because it's better to exist even with some limitations or challenges you face than not. I mean, most people, this is why people don't tend to commit suicide, is because they recognize that even with whatever suffering life may have, they're still coming out on the plus side. They still want to live. They still think it's better to live even with some suffering than not live. And so God recognized that on our behalf. And furthermore, God recognizes, even though a lot of people don't, that this is a temporary thing, that as long as we're open to his offer of salvation, he'll save us and he'll take us to a state in the next life where we don't have suffering of any kind. As the book of Revelation says, every tear will be wiped away and we'll have nothing but joy. St. Paul similarly says in his letters that the sufferings of this life are not worth comparing to the weight of glory that God has in store for us. So what God has prepared for us vastly exceeds the suffering we have in this life. And so regardless of the fact that we may have some suffering now, we're going to come out on the plus side. And according to the Catechism of the Catholic Church, God wouldn't allow any suffering at all to occur if he didn't have a way to bring an equal or greater good out of it. So for whenever God allows evil or suffering in the world, it's only because he has a way to bring about an equal or greater good. And that means, and you know, personally, I'm fine with that deal. I've had a lot of suffering in my life, but if God has something better for me, I'd much rather be here and be able to have that than, and if I have to go through that suffering, that's okay with me. I won't enjoy the suffering, but I trust God, and if he has something better for me, that's okay. I'm okay with the suffering. It's like getting a shot, you know? Getting a shot's painful, but if it stops a disease I've got,
yeah,
I'll take the shot. And in the same way, I'll take the deal. I would rather exist and have some suffering but get to this ultimate good place than not.
I'm sorry. I'm not going to go back to you, Renee, because I made a terrible mistake and I am humiliated and I need to correct it. I'm not going to Dublin, Ohio. I'm going to Delaware, Ohio.
Delaware.
I got my brain crossed up. So that happens to me sometimes. Uh-huh. I don't know. I got the signals crossed. Delaware, Ohio. St. Mary's in Delaware, Ohio.
Okay.
Not Dublin, Ohio.
Okay.
But it allowed me to do my Dublin joke.
It did.
So
now you'll have to come up with a Delaware joke.
Oh, that seems a lot harder. All right.
So, okay, Della is a woman's name, right?
Yeah.
So what's Delaware in today?
Oh, what's the Delaware? Easy peasy. Oh, yeah. You're very creative, Jimmy Akin. I didn't even get the name right of the place I'm going this weekend,
well,
and I was
not,
really looking
I mean,
forward to going that, to it, but well, I don't know how I crossed that up. But
that's par for the course. Linguists have determined that about every 1,000 words that come out of our mouths, we say the wrong word.
Oh, I'm just going to say less then. Mm-hmm. Way fewer
that
mistakes.
That would result in fewer errors.
Yeah. I will be in Delaware, Ohio this weekend at St. Mary's after the Saturday evening mass and a couple of the Sunday masses. I apologize to the entire populace of Delaware, Ohio for calling it Dublin, Ohio. Tomorrow we have 2 hours with Trent Horn on this program. 2 hours.
Hey.
What's he going to do? He's doing which Catholic moral teaching do you reject? Which Catholic moral teaching do you reject? So if there's something that the Catholic Church teaches morally that you got a problem with, tomorrow is your time with Trent for 2 hours. Jimmy Akin has been our guest this hour. He's the author of The Bible is a Catholic Book. His podcast is Jimmy Akin's Mysterious World. You should check it out tomorrow. It's about
Devil's Den UFO encounter.
Yeah, it is. Devil's Den UFO encounter. Thank you, Jimmy.
My pleasure.
Always enjoy 2 hours with you. We'll see you tomorrow, God willing, right here, Catholic Answers Live. Maybe some groovy music. I don't know.